Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 105. I'm recording it on Tuesday, March 10th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 12. That's a little below fair value. Stocks purchased today offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com site. And I like this one. It's the title of the selection on this podcast is Comic Plotting. The title of the podcast is You Can Get Rich Quick While Also Getting Rich. Wait a minute. Let me try to get this one right. You can get rich quick while also getting rich slow. It's not an either or. It's not an either or. More and more. I'm always thinking about investing. The man who never wanted to know anything about investing has been forced against its will to become the greatest investing expert who ever lived, whether he likes the idea or not. You will do this. You will do this, Rob. All right, God. You want to put me through hell here on earth. I was very bad in a past life. I will be an investing expert, whether I like the idea or not. One of the things I've discovered and keeps getting drilled into my head is that what matters in success in investing, and in other things too, but I think in particularly in investing, this has been overlooked. What matters is the fundamentals. You get the ABCs right, you're on your way. And you'll make mistakes. And you'll hit bumps in the road, but you'll end up fine. You get the ABCs wrong, and you'll have those days where you're jumping up and down and you think you've got it all figured out. And sooner or later, you will figure out a way to destroy yourself. You've got to get those ABCs right. You've got to get those fundamentals right. And this is the pain we are living through today, is that our focus has been on the surface stuff, not the fundamentals, and people were happy with that. There were many, many people who have warned that, hey, you're doing it all wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, this passive investing stuff can never work, it's crazy. But people said, hey, my portfolio is looking good, I'm making money, I'm doing fine. I'd rather be rich than be smart. But it doesn't last. And if it doesn't last, it's no good. So you've got to have something lasting. Now, what, you know, the words I just said could have been spoken by any of the, you know, the big shots that post at bogleheads.org. I said, it's got to last, or it doesn't count. That sounds like what I'm saying is, get rich slow. I don't know if that's a motto at bogleheads.org. I don't think it's exactly a motto, but it's part of the mindset. What they mean when they say get rich slow is it has to last. Getting rich quick is gimmicks. Getting rich quick is financial porn. Getting rich quick is emotional. And getting rich slow is what lasts. Getting the smart people get rich slow. The dumb people get rich quick. And I certainly have some sympathies for that idea. I'm certainly in favor of long-term investing. But I think it's unbalanced. And the idea that getting rich slow is better than getting rich quick is so fundamental that people don't examine it. They just, it's words they don't examine the words. When they see them, they just, well, of course getting rich slow is the right thing. Who could question it? Getting rich slow is the right way. Getting rich quick is the wrong way. And I don't think that's right. I'll give you a couple examples. One, the first one, is one that I thought about for a long time. And I'm sure I'm right about that one. When I was putting together my retire early plan in the 1990s, I knew that I was going to be starting a freelance writing business. You know, it ended up being an internet writing business. And freelance writing is, of all the career fields you could pick, it's just about the worst. You know, I suppose poet might be a notch below, but you'd have to work to come up with one more risky. But I wouldn't say that it's the worst in terms of income. Freelance writing can lead to riches. If you have a successful book that sells a million copies, the leverage is astronomical. I mean, I had one of the first thing I did was I sold a report, Secrets of Retiring Early, at Motley Fool, and I made $15,000 in, what was it, 6 months? A little less than 6 months? That was with one report. If I was churning out four reports, that's $30,000 a year, and if I had four of those, you know, $30,000 times four is $120,000. That's a nice royalty stream. You know, the company went out of business, so you know, that put a crimp in that idea. But I just remember going to bed at night, and I'd wake up, and I had all this money in my account, and I hadn't been working, and you know, that's the way to get rich. That's it. I mean, but something like that, you see, a lot of people are going to find appeal in that. They're going to say, "Oh, I love that idea," and they're going to put all their chips on it. And they're not going to be able to make it. It's harder than it looks. It's about 80,000 times harder than it looks. Okay. You know, maybe that report I wrote just happened to be the right subject at the right time. You know, there were 150 people on that site when it opened, and you know, there were two or three of us that made money, so 147 didn't. But if you looked objectively, you might say, you know, the 147 reports look as good as the three. You know, maybe there's some little difference. Maybe they were lucky. Maybe it was timing. But the point is, risk, if you really think about what the word means, doesn't mean bad. Risk means, you know, potential, big potential upside, big potential downside. So when I say my writing business is risky, I don't mean that it's bad. I don't mean it's a bad financial idea. What I mean is it could make me millions. My book, Passion Saving, is a book for the general reader. It's not a book on some niche. It's a book that everyone who earns money, everyone who has a job, should read, in my opinion, to learn how to manage that money. It's a totally different approach to money management from the conventional ideas, one that I believe works, and everyone should read it. Well, if it ever builds up enough steam that it gets written up in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and it sells millions of copies, you know, I don't have to do any additional work, you know, to sell a million copies to you know, for what it takes to sell 1,000 copies. And then, you know, of course, if it sells a million copies, there's a million spin-offs. You know, you have passion-saving mugs and passion-saving t-shirts and so forth. And you know, so the upside potential is unlimited. But the downside potential is you could spend years of your life trying to build that business and never make a penny. Your expenses could be greater than your income. So it's high risk. Well, I knew I wanted to do this. This is what I wanted to do with my life. So what I said was, if I'm going to do that with my life, I'm married and I have kids. I can't throw everything into that. So I have to balance it with something safe. So that's why, you know, that's why I had a zero stock allocation starting in 1996. The reason I didn't think stocks were a good bet is because valuations were so high. But under the valuation-informed indexing strategy, the usual recommendation would be, even when stocks are at insane prices, you should own 20 to 30% stocks, because there's always that chance they're going to go up in the short term. But I can't afford that risk. So the way I would put it, in theoretical terms, is that I should always be, somebody in my circumstances should always be going with a stock allocation of maybe 25% less than what the typical person should be going with. So when the typical allocation was properly 25%, my allocation was properly 0%. But the point here is, in order to think, in order to come up with that plan, you have to have two elements. You sort of have a get rich quick element, which is the business. If my book, you know, if a major publisher discovers my website and says, this is the best writer on personal finance I have ever seen, and I want to sign this guy up, I want his book, and he sends me a contract for $1 million, I get rich quick. That's a fact. That's not getting rich. I mean, it's getting rich slow if you count from the day I first started researching the book back in 1991. If you want to put it that way, it's getting rich slow. But in terms of translating it into dollars, it could happen very quick. It could happen in a week. You know, $1 million in a week. So to the extent the book is going to get me rich at all, it's going to get me rich quick. It's a get-rich-quick vehicle. It's a get-rich-quick pursuit. Writing a best-selling nonfiction book is a get-rich-quick pursuit. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not bad. It's just you don't want all your chips on a get-rich-quick pursuit. So I didn't quit the job and pursue that until I had saved enough money to cover my basic expenses of life. So that I had investments that would cover food and shelter and medical care. So those things are covered without selling any books. But, of course, it wouldn't work unless the investments are safe. And that's the reason I explored, you know, valuations and didn't just go along with the conventional wisdom, because it would have wiped me out. But the point here is, the point I want to make in this podcast is, people think get rich quick is a bad thing, and people think get rich slow is a good thing, and it makes us unbalanced in our thinking about all sorts of subjects, but especially investing. And I think it's a mix that works. I there was a phrase I used, I remember, I think I used this phrase in the first book. The practical one married the dreamer. I had wanted to use that phrase, and I think I may have slipped it in somewhere, but I had wanted to have an entire section of the book on it. I don't, not a subsection of a chapter, but I think that was cut out. I just in editing, but I think I got the phrase in. I know I got the phrase in Practical Dreamer. I've always loved the phrase Practical Dreamer because it combines those two. The dreamer is the get rich quick guy. The practical is the get-rich-slow guy. And I believe in the practical one married the dreamer. That's the marriage made in heaven. That's my marriage. My wife is very practical, and I'm very much a dreamer. And we work together. Well, not always, but when we work together, the marriage is fantastic. We're a powerful team. When it's not working, I can't understand what the heck she's talking about. And I have a funny feeling she feels the same way. when it's not working, I'm talking, and you know, Ms. Practicality over there is like, what are you talking about? You know, but when it works, it works. So the theme I want to explore is it's really a mix of when you talk about investing, it's a mix of rational and emotional. And this is the big problem we're suffering today. You see, the reason why we're having such difficulty getting out of this economic crisis is the problem is fundamental. And people have a hard time questioning their fundamental beliefs. You've got to really, 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 really shake them up. And it takes, you know, it always takes a bull market. I've always mentioned we've been through this four times. We've suffered bone-crushing losses every single time. And that it's not an accident. And people think, well, maybe that's just a coincidence. You know, what does that prove? It's not a coincidence. It has to be that way. Because the type, only one thing can cause an insane bull market. Only one thing. Refusal to look at prices. If people look at prices, there can never be an out-of-control bull market. It's a physical, logical impossibility. So you've got to believe in passive investing to have a massive bull market. And a massive bull market has to cause a massive bear market, because the market must ultimately reflect reasonable prices. So anytime there's a massive bull market, you know darn well there's going to be a massive bear market. It's going to wipe everybody out. It's got to be. And it all comes down to lack of balance. What's needed for effective long-term investing is a combination of the practical and the dreamy. And it's true in all areas of life endeavor. It's reflected in the stock market, just because the stock market, the market is people. And that's how people are. People are not robots. They're not, numbers crunchers. They do have number crunching capacities, and that's nice. There's not a thing wrong with it. But humans also paint and draw and sing. This is why I used to quote Beatles lyrics when I was at Vanguard Diehards, and this is why it drove Mel Lindauer freaking nuts. Because I think Beatles lyrics tell us more about investing than the Sharpe ratio. And Mel thinks it's an insult to the Sharpe ratio that I would say that Beatles lyrics tell us more than the Sharpe ratio. So we were at loggerheads, but I don't think we should be. I want to be Mel's pal. I want to shake his hand and say, hey man, why do I want to shake his hand? Because Mel can work the numbers for me. I ain't no numbers guy. And I want to tap in to the abilities of people like Mel, but I sure don't want to be cowed by him. I don't want to be telling lies about what I believe about investing, because I know he's going to slam me over the head if I refer to a Beatles song. I've got to do my thing, and Mel has to do his thing for the whole thing to work. And the reason why we're in a stock crisis today is because it got unbalanced. Not just there, of course. That's just got unbalanced to Vanguard Diehards, because it's unbalanced everywhere. It's like a cancer that's spread. The cancer is called passive investing, and the reason why it's a cancer is passive investing is rooted in the efficient market theory, which says that the market is 100% rational, which implicitly says humans are 100% rational, and that, my friends, is a lie. Some think it's a pretty lie. Some think, oh, I'd love it if people were 100% rational. I don't personally even think it's a pretty lie. I like emotion. So I don't even want to live in a world where people are 100% rational. I call that world hell. So I don't even want it. But some people find appeal in it. But whether you find appeal in it or you hate it, it ain't the world we live in. So we ought to come out of the dream world and start investing, according to the way investing works in the real world, the world in which the stock market is comprised of people, and people have both reason and emotions. Now, I have some examples from different areas of life endeavor, where I have found that success is a mixture of emotion and reason. But this is fundamental. It came up in a discussion I had yesterday, Monday. There's a guy named Artie, and he's come to the site before, and he's a great poster, one of the best. And but Artie was posting like a madman yesterday. I think it was on a thread at the blog called something called the Permanent Portfolio. I forget the full name of it, but if you entered Permanent Portfolio, I think you would find the blog entry. And I think it was called This Month's Permanent Portfolio. That's what it was called. This Month's Permanent Portfolio. It was one of the first blog entries. And you know, Artie went back to that thread and added some comments, and then he kept firing back. I would answer his comments, and he would fire back. And I think we ended up with over 75 posts, and some of them pretty long. But a lot of them good, a lot of good stuff. If you enter that in the search box, you should find it. But Artie, he wants to help me, and he's trying to help me market this stuff. And you know, he said, "Oh, you should set up a fund. You know, there should be a valuation-informed indexing fund. You could run it." And I've had, yeah. Well, first of all, I can't run it because I'm not qualified. But you know, it's a kind thought. But I've had other people suggest this. Why don't you set up a fund? Or get a fund set up. What we need is a fund. And we don't need a fund. I mean, I don't have an objection. If somebody wants to set up a valuation-informed indexing fund, I don't see it would do any harm. But we don't need a fund. People don't really understand what valuation-informed indexing is when they say to set up a fund. Because when they say set up a fund, the suggestion is valuation-informed indexing is one more form of investing. You know, there's all these others out there. There's momentum investing, and there's contrarian investing, and there's value investing, and there's, you know, passive investing, and there's valuation-informed indexing. I don't think that's right. The rational investing model is one step, theoretically, above all of those. Those are all different forms of rational investing, except passive is not. Passive is in conflict with rational. Because passive, the idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation is 100% emotion. So that's not, you can't have that within the rational umbrella, I don't think. But everything else can fit in the rational umbrella. Stock picking and contrarian and value and small cap and momentum. Technical analysis, that all can fit under a rational umbrella as long as you're trying to as long as you're emotionally balanced and you're trying to achieve good returns with low risk. Now, of course, everybody says they're doing that, but what you have to do is take a step back and say, are they? You know, the passives say that they're rational, to be sure. They say they're totally rational. They say they're scientific. But what I say is, if you get as emotional about, you know, in response to questioning of your ideas as the passives do, you know, you ain't rational. Rational. So what makes it rational? What makes it rational is that rational investors, the key characteristic is they accept that they are emotional. See, it's a paradox. Deny your emotions, which is what passives do. They say, oh, the market's efficient. Well, if the market were efficient, that would mean we'd all be 100% rational. Otherwise, it wouldn't be efficient. They say the market price is right. All this stuff you hear about. Have you ever heard you can't beat the market? Why do they say you can't beat the market? Because they're saying the market is efficient. The market is rational. If the market is irrational, of course you could beat it. All you'd have to do is be rational yourself and you'd beat it. But they say, oh, no, no. Market's efficient. Market's rational. You can't beat the market. Well, if the market is efficient and the market is rational, then the people comprising it sure must be rational. What they're saying is that collectively, human beings are rational. And I say no. I say collectively, we are irrational. More irrational than rational. And I'm saying if you want to be an effective investor, you have to acknowledge that. And once you acknowledge it, you're home free. Because then all you do is you look at how rational is the market at any given time. And when the market is rational, you invest heavily in stocks. And when the market is bonkers, like it was from 1995 through the first part of 2008, you pull back. You go down to a 20% allocation because you know that those who ignore the irrationality are going to get killed. So valuation-informed indexing is not, it's not just some new little approach. The way I would put it is we don't need a fund for valuation-informed indexers. If the rational investing idea catches on, all approaches are going to consider valuations, not just this one. The people picking stocks are going to consider valuations, and the momentum investors are going to consider it, and the small cap people, and the contrarians, and the passives, everybody. And if everybody considers it, you won't need a fund. All the other funds will get good results. In other words, my argument is there are all sorts of ways to invest. There's not just one. You know, different people are going to come up with different ways, and because they come from different sets of life experiences, and that's fine. I like Bogle's way because it's, I like indexing because it's simple for the average person, that's all. I don't say it's the only way that can work, or any of this gibberish. That stuff is dogmatism, defensiveness. Lots of things can work. This is the best way. Indexing is the best way for the average person, that's what I say. But it's got to be valuation-informed indexing, because if it's passive indexing, you're going to get crushed. Passives always get crushed. No exceptions in the historical record. So why would you want to have the average person, millions of middle-class people, investing in the worst way imaginable? For what purpose? In the mass destruction of the economy? Is that the goal? So all I've done is take, you know, the best investing approach for average people and make it sane, make it so that it can work. That's all I'm trying to do. But if you're going to take that concept of rational investing, valuation-informed indexing, you could spread it. You know, you don't have to have a fund for it. If the idea catches on and millions of people understand that in order to invest, you need to consider price, which is duh. You know, we consider price in everything else we do. When we buy chairs and comic books and bananas and, you know, refrigerators, we should do it with stocks too. Duh. Well, if they do that, all of these approaches are going to work better than they do now. A rising tide lifts all boats. Helping middle-class workers to understand how investing works helps everybody. It's a win-win-win-win-win-win-win-win. No losers. So all I'm trying to say here is when people tell me I need a fund, I feel like they're sort of taking this idea and sticking it into that passive mode. They're thinking in passive mode. They're being kind. Artie has got my best interest at heart, I know. And the other one that he was suggesting is he was saying, well, you need to have a chart that shows people, you know, what allocation they should be at the different P10 levels. And lots of people have asked me that. And Artie's probably right on that one. I think enough people have told me that I'm about ready to give in. But I resist it. There's something inside me that resists it. And it's that I feel that people are trying to reduce investing to a totally... I have to be careful with this word rational, because I favor rational investing. A totally logical, maybe that's what I should say. People want numbers. Mechanical, maybe that's a better word. They want to make it mechanical. They want to make it mechanical. Oh, I see this all the time. You know, I like to tell people, look, I say a P10 of 20, that's dangerous. So I don't object to telling them what the numbers mean, but they want me to say, well, then, what allocation should I have at a P10 of 20? And there, I don't think there's one answer to that, because you know, right now we're at a P10 of 12, which is a great P10 level. It's great. Look at my calculator, the stock return predictor, and the most likely 10-year return. My recollection is 8% real, annualized. So for the next 10 years, you can have 8% plus inflation. That's awesome. But you can't look at that number in isolation. I do think that the typical investor today should be at, you know, around 50% stock, something like that, and go up if the P10 level continues to drop. 60 would be fine today. And if it drops below P10 of 10, you might want to go up to 80%. But I do feel that we need to tell people that, hey, you know, there's a PE10 of 12 is not always exactly the same thing. We're at a P10 of 12 today, but in the aftermath of the most insane bull market in history. So we really are playing with dynamite. There really is probably a 30% chance that we're going to end up in a bigger depression than the 1930s. And if that happens, it could be a long time. I still think in 10 years you're going to be okay, but you know, it might be 8 years of rocky road, you know, I can't say. So I feel I have to add that caution. Whereas if we were at a P10 level of 12 and we hadn't just come from the most insane bull market in history, I'd have a different take on it. So you can't just say PE 10 12, like that answers every question. And so I don't like reducing it to a number. I don't like reducing it to a chart. And I saw a guy and he did it. See, I'm going back and forth on this question of preparing a chart like that because Artie persuaded me, and I said to Artie, I'm going to do this. You know, it's not the top thing on my list, but I need to do this because I've had a lot of people ask me. But then there was a guy at Vanguard Diehards today who did a chart. It wasn't on valuation informed indexing, but he was comparing different things. And it was a very nice chart. It went from 1974 where he was comparing passive with looking at valuations, and then he had other factors in there. And the chart was very well done. But the reaction is what you always see. Everybody jumped in. And they're all looking at it from their different perspectives, you know. They're different emotional take. And so the passives are saying, oh, great, this chart proves we're right. And the ones that care about valuations are saying, oh, great, this chart proves we're right. And the ones that like to pick stocks are saying, oh, great, this chart proves we're right. Well, what good does the chart do if everyone's just going to, you know, look for some way to twist it to supporting them? What I'm saying is that's the emotion here, it's the driver. And we've got to start talking about what is it that makes them all want to use any chart produced by anybody on earth to prove their particular little points. That's the problem. It's all this quarreling and gibberish and nonsense. And all of that comes from defensiveness. All of that comes from fear. All of that comes from not understanding the ABCs. So we've got to get back to those basics. And I can't, you know, I address those sorts of questions in every podcast. But the one I want to focus on in this one is the balance that is needed between emotion and reason. And the practical one married the dreamer. That's the phrase I love. Or the just practical dreamer sums it up really quick. You've got to have those two things, you know, the yin and yang working together. The woman and the man, you know. There's a reason why God made women and men. And, you know, as a generalization, they say women, you know, are stronger on intuition and men are stronger on logic. In my marriage, it's the other way. That's the generalization, but it's a good marriage that has both. If you have, you know, think about starting a business. Who is the best person in the world to start a business? You know, a part of me says an accountant. An accountant can be great at starting a business because he knows the numbers, and businesses are all about numbers. And if the numbers work, you know, you're gonna get this leverage working for you, and you're gonna overcome every obstacle. But accountants aren't the best because accountants, it depends. They need to hook up with a creative. Because an accountant, they're not great marketers. Accountants, you know, they don't know how to do marketing campaigns because they're not skilled at reaching people's emotions. They're skilled at facts. But businesses are people enterprises. You've got to sell to people. You've got to get people to buy. But you marry an accountant with a creative. You know, you've got a creative who has an idea for, you know, an Indiana Jones movie, and you get an accountant that does the books. so that they know what spin-offs to do and, you know, what sort of serial rights to get and how many countries to, you know, show the thing in, how many theaters you have to open with to get the biggest bang for the buck, and you know, stand back and count the money. You got to have those two elements. Now, I'll give an example from my life that really hit me. This is where this idea really hit with me, and I just know it's true because of this example. When I was writing my book, I was very I had high standards, and it was not a knockoff book. I sweated blood, and I had standards I wanted to achieve. I did achieve them, but it was hard. It almost killed me. That was the hardest thing I ever did. And I read, you know, when I was sort of struggling with it, I knew the ideas, but I wanted to get the presentation right. And I was struggling with it, and I went to Amazon, and I was just ordering, you know, 10 books on writing at a time. I was reading everything I could read. And the standard advice, and this is the advice I remember the nuns giving me back at old St. Timothy's, outline. You know, your assignment for the week would be write an essay. Well, not they wouldn't even let you write the essay. That was what killed me. You had to write an outline of an essay. You know, the assignment was come back with a, you know, the whatever your theme was. You know, what I did on summer vacation. But they didn't want an essay. They wanted you to come back with a. You know, a title, and then you know, an opening statement, and then, you know, part one, part two, part three, and then, you know, closing summary statement. And those things used to drive me bonkers. And literally, what I would do when I had an assignment like that, I would write the essay, because it took me less time to write the essay than to write the outline. I would write the essay, and then I'd go back and say, okay, now I have the essay. What kind of outline can I pull out of this? Because my essays were always organized. They're organized in my head. They come out organized. But writing an outline, I can't stand it. I mean, it's pain. So I can write the essay, you know, in 5 minutes and then say, okay, well, in my first paragraph, I talked about this. I'll put in part A, you know. And so, you know, you'd hand that in and you know, and the nun would approve it. And then she'd say, okay, now write the essay. And then you would turn the paper in that you had written the first time. But the point was, you know, you had to write the outline. You couldn't write the essay because what they were trying to teach you was how to use an outline to structure your work. Now, the nuns were not trying to hurt us. The good sisters of St. Joseph loved us. They were trying to help us. And all the people who recommend outlines in writing, and there are people I've spoken to who will tell you that they never had any success at writing until they did outlines because their writing was not structured. And structure is the most important thing in writing. I don't dispute that at all. If you go through my book or my post or my articles, there's a lot of structure. I'm ruthless about it. I try to be. I think I am. I think I don't think you can give me too many knocks on the structure department. These podcasts aren't always super well structured. This is an informal medium. There's a little bit, but they're not structured tightly. But the articles and the book and the posts, those are structured. You know, it's got an organization. And I make this point, and then that flows into this point, and that flows into that point, and it all gets tied together. Well, as I say, I don't do that consciously. That comes out of me. But it comes out because the reason why it's structured is because the thoughts are structured. I thought about this stuff in my head, and so it comes out structured. If I was writing about something I didn't know, it would not be structured, and it would be a big mess. And that's where outlines play a role. See, the outline is the logic part. And the other stream of consciousness writing is the emotion part. And I'm, you know, what I'm arguing here is that both of these things are needed for success. And they're needed for success in writing, and they're needed for success in investing. And what people tend to do is jump to one or the other. There are people in camps. And they say, well, I'm in the structure camp. You've got to have an outline to be a good writer. And lots of books I picked up said that. And then other people will say, no. They have something called flow. They say, the great novelists get into a flow, and all the words come out. And some people don't believe them. They'll say, that can't be true. They say they wrote 500 pages just sitting there at the table. No, it can't work that way. You've got to outline. And they'll say, well, sorry, that's how I do it. I can't do it any other way. Well, the reason is because they've essentially done the outlining step in their head without being aware of it. If you study something long enough, your brain supplies the outline. You can't do it without work. It takes sweat. So, you know, the Mark Twain quote, you know, that's 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration, or whoever said it. It's true. But the perspiration doesn't have to be writing an outline. There's different ways of doing it. And there was a book I read that explained this better than anything I've seen. It was called Power Writing. And the guy had this technique that sounds crazy. But he would say, if you want to be a good writer, he'd say, don't do any outline at all. Just sit down and write stream of consciousness, whatever comes to your head, without any censor at all. Just any idiot idea, and just scribble it down. And don't stop because it's not grammatical or it doesn't make sense. Just scribble it down like a crazy person. And people resist that. But he's doing that to free up this emotional side, this stream of consciousness side of the human mind. And then after you do that, he'd say, okay, now go back and pull out the two sentences and all that garbage that have any value. Throw the rest out. But now you've got two sentences. And that's sort of a mini outline. Then take the first sentence and do a stream of consciousness on that. And then you'll get two more sentences. And it's a process of, it's sort of like, you know, if you have something, he had a word for this process of flipping back and forth from the outlining, you know, part of the brain to the free association part of the brain. And it's sort of like, the word he had, I think it was a word for when you unscrew something, and there are screws, you know, four that go around, and you have to loosen a little bit on one, but not all the way, and then loosen the second, and then loosen the third, and then loosen the fourth, and then go back to the first. In other words, it has to be done in a circular way, and that's how the human mind works, I believe. So you have to go, it's the emotion that generates the power, the power writing. But you've got to have the structure. You can't do away with it. It's just we can't do it at the same time. So you've got to have all this stream of consciousness, then you've got to rein it in with an outline and structure it. Then stream of consciousness, and then rein it in. And each circle, you get closer to a strong piece of writing that has both structure, which you must have, and blood, which you must have. That's the power part. That's the part where all the people that tell you to do outlines forget about, and they kill the life out of the thing. You know, it's an essay that passes all the tests, but it doesn't connect with anybody. Well, you know, you may feel I'm getting a foul here of get rich quick versus get rich slow, but I don't think so. This motto, get rich slow, you know, a lot of people, what goes on is that a lot of people in the personal finance area fall for get-rich-quick schemes, and that's the appeal to the emotion. And so we've responded to that, you know, Bogle responded to that with this rational, so-called rational approach, which is get-rich-slow. But that's a denial of emotion. And that's stale and dead. And that's why passive investors are so defensive and so rigid. They've taken the life out of their strategy. And it doesn't work that way. And what we have to do is stop this, stop appealing to emotional extremes. In order not to appeal emotional extremes, we need to make friends with the two parts of the human personality. The emotion side has to be friends with the rational side. And then you've got a machine that can think clearly and creatively. You need to be clear. You need to have the outline. You need to have the structure. But you also need to be creative so that you can see when you're making a terrible mistake like they did in thinking the market was efficient. You see, the people that came up with that idea, they're smart people. They're so smart they outsmart themselves. They make mistakes and there's no room in their system for mistakes. So they can't recognize them. If they would shoot from the hip a little more, they would know that people make mistakes and they would accept it. And they'd just say, oh, you know, like that girl said at the moot court, I'm stumped, Your Honor. They can't do that. These experts, these investing experts, can't make mistakes because it's just foreign to their system. And that's how they got trapped. That's how they killed themselves and all of us. So we need a new way of, we don't just need new ideas in investing. We need a whole new way of thinking about investing. A balanced way, which includes both, which has room both for emotions and for logic. I think about this in terms of the Catholic Church. I'm a Catholic, and my religion means something to me. And there's two great doctors, and you know, when I speak about this, I'm no expert in the Catholic faith. So, you know, I'm giving you a sort of a, what I understand. So if I'm wrong, please send me an email, let me know. But my understanding is there are two great doctors of theology in the Catholic Church. And Thomas Aquinas is the great logical guy, the great rational guy. And he wrote these long books, Summa, what was it called? Summa Theologica, I think, maybe. I'm not sure. But some huge book, you know, it's like 15,000 pages. And he answers every question, you know, why is there God? And, you know, what is God made of? And why are there angels? And how do we know there are angels? And you know, every book. And then he's got, you know, 15 arguments for why we think this and 15 for why we think that. And then compares them and contrasts them. And then he comes to a conclusion and it goes, you know, like that. And so he was just, you know, brilliant genius. Answered every question there was. I think it was in response to Aquinas that, you know, people got worn down with all this rationalizing, depending on, you know, reasoning or rationalizing, depending on how you feel about it. And they said, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? You know, Thomas Aquinas would write a 300-page essay on it. Well, I think there's a place for that. We need to think these issues through. Aquinas added something. I would love to read his book, and I've never found time for it because time is limited in the modern day, but before I die, I would like to. But, he was the guy who defended the Catholic faith from the standpoint of reason. He answered every logical objection, or tried to. Now, the other guy, the guy who's a little more after my own heart, is Augustine, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine has my two favorite sayings in religion. I gave my boy the middle name Augustine. One is just love, and I think he meant love God, but love God, and everything else will follow. You know, everything else will take care of itself. And this is how I teach my boys. In other words, you know, I think I have an obligation to teach them the catechism, to teach them the Ten Commandments and the sort of things. And I do that, but I don't worry about it too much. I feel, yeah, if they get it right, that's good. And if they don't, they'll get it later. But I sure make an effort to teach them to love God. I try to bring up God, you know, I don't know, when we were at the one I always think of is we went to a water park in Philadelphia, Sesame Place, and they have fantastic water rides there. And it was a sunny day. It was this perfect day, I think, in July. And it was just, you know, it was morning, so it wasn't ungodly hot yet. And the first ride we went on, it was a family thing. Everybody can get on a raft. And you go way up. It's the highest thing in the park. And, you know, you're sort of on this raft. And you go down, and you got these, you know, these big drops. And there's water shooting out. And, you know, it's just perfect. And the weather was perfect. It was... And my boy, of course, when this was a couple years ago, I don't know, he might have been six, And just as we start, you could just, he was looking down at it, and he had this look on his face, you know, I wish I had a picture. And it was just like, this is the greatest idea anyone ever came up with, you know. This is just so great that somebody did this. And I was, you know, it makes you happy when you see that. And you know, when we were off the ride, when we were going home, I said, Tim, you know, that, you know, I said, why do you think that's there? Why did God put that there? I said, God put that there for us all to have a taste of heaven. He wants us to know what heaven is like. He wants us to know what our struggle's about. Well, I say things like that because I want him to love God. I want my boys to love God. And I feel if they love God, they'll figure out the commandments. You know, they'll figure it out. They'll read their Aquinas one of these days if they love God. But if you don't love God, you can know all the commandments. This is just me speaking here. This isn't the Catholic Church. It's just me. I hope I'm not getting in trouble with the Catholic Church. But, you know, if you that, to me, that's what lasts. You know, love will get you through. Love will keep us together. But, you know, if you have that, you'll figure out all the rules. So I'm a guy that does that. The other one, I have to mention it, because I've mentioned it before, but the other one from Augustine was the Augustine prayer, which is really the Rob Bennett prayer, when he said, "Dear God, please make me chaste, but not just yet." You know, "Dear God, please help me to give up chocolate chip cookies, but you know, I do want two after dinner tonight. We could start tomorrow morning." That's, you know, I think that distinction is what the problem with our investing crisis today is all about. We turned to the logic side in the development of this model called, it's the efficient market theory, and the practical application of it is called passive investing. We turned 100% to the Aquinas mode. We've got all the rules figured out, and we've got every objection answered with precision and charts and tables. Oh, links all over the internet. You know, you go to Taylor Larimore and you say, "Taylor, how do you know this works?" And he's got 60 quotes from all the experts, and they all agree, and it's all pat, and it's all figured out, and it's all 100% BS. Without the life, without the emotion, it's dead. It's dead. Gotta have those Beatle lyrics, Mel. That's part of the deal. It's dead. Why is it dead? It doesn't work, does it? Not because they're stupid. These people are smart. They're not stupid. Not because they want to screw up their retirements. They obviously want their retirements to succeed. But because they're scared little boys and girls, and they bought into this, and now they're painted themselves into a corner, and they can't admit they're wrong. They're emotionally unbalanced. The approach is emotionally unbalanced. It forces them to become emotionally unbalanced. Because it's all logic, and all logic is hell. All logic is death. Did you ever have a date with somebody who was all logic? You know, I mean, I could say it the other way. I could say, did you ever have a date with somebody who was all emotion? They'll drive you nuts, too. It's just as bad. Someone who's there and here, and you can't make sense out of it, and they're crying, and they're laughing. And you're like, whoa, I've got to disengage. I need some logic. I need some firm ground. Well, you do. But when it's all logic, and, you know, you're tied to the ground, and you can't ever even look at the clouds. You can't have a creative thought. You can't draw outside the lines. That's dead. Life is in the middle of those two. So you've got to mix Aquinas and Augustine. You know, you do have to have the rules. I mean, Jesus said that. He said, "I have come not to bury the law. You know, I've come to, what, give it life? I've come to fulfill it." Jesus took some of those commandments and gave us a living example of them and brought them to life and added some charity to them. and brought them to life. And I think that's what we need to do in the investing realm. I always say, oh, passive investing is 100% wrong. And it is, from one way of looking at it. But if you look at the details, you know, piece by piece, there's no one that I borrow from more than John Bogle. You know, lots of his ideas are the best ideas out there. But he killed them all with this idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to price changes. That's crazy talk. And he bought into it because of the sufficient market theory, which tries to take investing and turn it into something sterile and dead and predictable and easy to understand. They don't want to talk about humans. Who knows what those humans will do? These are engineers and accountants and economists. They don't want to talk about humans, those beings. Who knows what they're going to do? They're singing Beatles songs half the time. We can't have that. Well, fine. Don't have it. But without it, you won't understand what you're doing. And if you don't understand what you're doing, you're going to mess up. The podcast title is the phrase that sums it all up. Because the question is not, is passive investing stupid? It's stupid, believe me. And I can demonstrate it, 500 times over. But the question is, why do people buy into it if it's so stupid? It's because of the marketing pitch. And the marketing pitch for passive investing is get rich slow. We have been deceived into thinking that the answer to financial freedom is getting rich slow. And the reason why it tricks us is because there's so much truth in it. Getting rich quick is not the answer. Going with all emotion is not the answer. You know, go off, find your dream. What was it they used to say? Do what you love and the money will follow. Well, a lot of people do what they love and the money doesn't follow. And the people who push get rich slow are responding to that. And the middle class loves it because they know that it's not really true. That if you do what you love, the money will follow. Sometimes it is. But there's a lot of risk. You know, if you're 20 years old, maybe so. But if you're 40 and you've got a family and a mortgage, it's not so hot an idea to just throw away the big paycheck. But if you don't do what you love, if you just do the practical thing all the time, you're going to end up getting fired because you're going to get so bored with the job that you're going to mess up and you're going to lose it. And the practical thing is going to be worth nothing. That's what has happened to the passive investors. They became so dogmatic that they destroyed the market. They made it impossible for the market to survive. They got to lighten up. They got to tell a joke. Like John Walter Russell says, they have to have fun. That's part of the equation. That's part of the equation. Emotions are part of the equation. You got to let the sunshine in. It's a balance, and this dead approach, but important. The dead approach is get rich slow, but it's important. I call it dead. Both of these approaches, one is dangerous and one is dead. Both of them are bad by themselves. Getting rich quick is not the answer. Getting rich slow is not the answer. What you have to do is combine them. One of the things, the last podcast was on probability investing. I think you should be playing probabilities all the time. That doesn't mean you should always be playing the bets that are most likely to come in. Say you're at the racetrack. Do you always bet the favorite? I don't. Sometimes I'll bet a long shot. Say there's a horse that pays 20-1, and I think he's got a 10-1 chance. That's a good bet. It's probably not going to come in. But if it does come in, the payoff is enough to make up for, the 9 times it won't come in. It's more than enough. That's why I end up ahead. So if you bet, you know, if you bet 10-1 shots when you get 20-1 odds, you're going to end up ahead in the long run. There's nothing wrong with betting long shots. Now, if all your money is on long shots, that's not so smart. Because then you end up too far behind and you panic. And when you panic, you lose all your power. You lose all your options. So that's not the way to go. That's too much get rich quick. What you need, and I can't give you the exact mix, but I think what you need is a base. What it really comes to is you need a base of get rich slow. You've got to have enough security in your life, enough practicality, that you're not going to panic. That in a worst case scenario, you're just barely okay. And in a best case scenario, you're riding high. That's your base. That's your safe stuff. That's the money I've got in tips and I-bonds. 3.5% real, come rain, come shine. Rock solid. I know I've got it. Then, I don't want to stay. I don't want to have everything in tips paying 3.5% real. That's getting rich slow. It's too slow. I want to have a little bit of a risk layer. My risk layer is my business. If my business comes in, you know, when I make $1 million, I might not need the tips and I-bonds anymore. You know, I'll be at a situation where I don't need so much security. But today I need it. And so I'm not going to go along with these fools who tell me, you know, 74% stocks is optimal for everybody. You know, these idiots. Not that they're dumb people, you know. Whenever I say that, I feel like I'm... Let's say the ideas are idiotic, not the people. The people are not idiots. The ideas are idiot ideas. That's the better way to say it. But they hurt people. That's what causes me to say something like that. They hurt people with these dogmatic pronouncements, these defensive pronouncements. And I just see, you know, in the investing field, this is everywhere. It's not one person. It's not like I can identify one person and say, well, avoid this person. It's everywhere. It's endemic. And of course, there are people out there. The one that I think of when you're comparing get rich quick versus get rich slow, I think of Robert Kiyosaki. Extremely popular. Probably if you were going to name the two most popular, who are the two most popular personal finance people? I mean... Well, Susie Orman is definitely one. She's probably the most popular of all, but second is probably Robert Kiyosaki, and third is probably John Bogle. And I think of Kiyosaki and Bogle as being pretty much opposites. You talk about Kiyosaki at the you know, Bogle heads, and they, you know, they want to hang him from a tree. And I, you know, there are things about Kiyosaki that I don't like. I'm not crazy about everything he says, but of course there are things about Bogle I don't like. I think, frankly, if you looked at who has cost the middle class worker more money, more of his or her life savings, it's John Bogle. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think it's true. The get rich slow approach has cost us more than the get rich quick approach. Kiyosaki's sort of get rich quick. You know, neither one is going to say that they are, but, that, you know, Kiyosaki is much more of a, I don't know what the word is exactly, you know, a hustler approach. But what I like, there's a, you know, when I see somebody sell as many books as Kiyosaki has sold, I'm not willing to dismiss it as financial porn and just say that's all there is to it. I feel if you sell that many books, you're touching a nerve. There's got to be something there that is touching people. And I think what's touching people is people have caught on that the get rich slow isn't going to work for them. That the, you know, there are certain people it might work for. If you've got a 100% secure job, you can just sort of plug along for 40 years. But not too many of us have this situation. And so a lot of people feel, I've got to get rich quick before time runs out. And Kiyosaki has a little more appeal to that side. But some of the ideas, I feel that he does tease too much in his books. He suggests things that are very valuable, but you know, you keep reading and it's hard to get to the point sometimes, and I find that frustrating. So I can't say that he's my favorite, but I see things that I see what he's getting at sometimes. And it's a counter Bogle approach. And if I had to describe the difference in a phrase, I'd say the difference is Kiyosaki is more attuned to get rich quick, and Bogle is more attuned to get rich slow. And both have emotional appeal. People that go for the get rich slow will say, oh, I'm superior. I don't let emotions affect me. I don't let marketing pitches affect me. It's all just reason for me. One of those people that you can't market to me because I'm just all reason. Oh, you're all reason. That's good. But if you're all reason, why did you fall for the lie that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels? You see, you fell for it because you want to be thought of as all reasonable. And that's what the all reasonable people believe, you see? It's just another form of marketing pitch. The way to overcome your vulnerability to marketing pitches is to know the story, what all marketing is based on. It's almost always based on emotion. And I don't even think that's bad. It's just the way it is. But the trick, the defense is, you know, a lot of people think the answer is to get cynical. Oh, yeah, you know, they're cynical. Oh, if anybody had a good idea, they would just, they would use it themselves. They wouldn't write a book, and they wouldn't tell you. If anybody knew how to time the market, they wouldn't tell you. Now, there's some truth in that. It's true in many cases, but it's not always true. There are timing approaches that work, and those are the ones you need to know about, and there are many that don't work. They don't say it about, you know, the Bogleheads don't say that about Bogle. They don't say, oh, well, Bogle only wrote his books to get rich. You know, Bogle's a saint. Bogle's out for the little guy, but everybody else can't trust. You know, what I say is there's a lot in Bogle that's great, and we should mine it. And there's some boners in there, and we should put up warning signs. And if there's anything good in Kiyosaki, why don't we go after it and take advantage of it? And if there's any good in Susie Orman, let's take that. And if there's any good in Warren Buffett or in Robert Shiller, whoever it is. I think the smart approach is not cynicism. And it's not just, you know, saying that this is my guru, I'm going to do whatever he says. It's mixing the two. And so when you deny that getting rich quick, the truth of the matter is, wealth is sometimes distributed to us through a slow process and sometimes through a fast process. And that's just the way it is. What we have in the past year is a get poor quick approach. The get-rich-slow people found in the past 15 months that what they really have is get-poor-quick. Well, that's what happens when you teach people that valuations don't matter. You cause valuations to shoot through the moon, you know, for a number of years, and then to fall through, you know, the floor, so that you lose 10 years of gains in 1 year. But if all these people believe in buy and hold, they can't protect themselves. They're totally, totally unprotected. So what I'm getting at is we have to get down to the emotional core, why we believe the things we do about investing. And a lot of times, all the arguments people put forward, it's all just rationalizations, 90% of it. It's, as I say, you can put up these charts, doesn't mean a thing. Because five people with five different philosophies will all say that the chart proves they're right. What matters is the emotional filter that is causing them, that determines how they interpret the chart. And the emotional filter for a lot of us is, are we in the get-rich-quick camp or are we in the get-rich-poor camp? And they're seen as enemy camps. Get-rich-quicks can't talk to get-rich-poors. Oh no. Bad. You know, it's Jets versus Sharks. And I say the get-rich-quicks sometimes have a point. Getting rich quick is nice. There's not a thing wrong with it. In moderation. Even Bogle even suggests this. You know, he has this concept of play money. He says you should have most of your money in an index, but it won't hurt to have a little bit, little bit of fun money. I think that's emotionally healthy that he says that. But he's sort of patronizing about it. It's sort of like, well, if you can't help yourself, it's not such a bad idea. I would take it a step beyond that. I'd say you should have a base that is conservative, get rich slow, and you should have a get rich quick element in your plan. Some kind of get rich quick element. I have a big get rich quick element in my plan just because the type of business I wanted to pursue is just a get rich quick sort of enterprise. But if you don't have that, you should have some of your stock should be, you know, if you're going to index with 80% of your money, 20% should be where you pick a stock. And you don't worry about the safety of the stock. You go for something that's going to make you a bundle. Now, maybe not 20%, maybe 5%. 5% might be better. But the point is, have something that gives the plan some life. And you might lose that 5%. But that having that 5% to pursue will give you the excitement you need to get excited about your overall plan, which is 95% safe and reliable and practical. In other words, we should openly be talking about our desire to get rich quick. We shouldn't be ashamed of it. It's not something to hide and cover up and apologize for. We should be open about it. By becoming open about it, we sort of get it out of our systems. It doesn't have the same power over you when you're open about it. When you cover it up, it sort of sneaks up on you. And it controls you. It influences you without you really knowing that it's doing it. And I think that's what happens to the bogleheads, the people who call themselves bogleheads. I think I'm more of a boglehead than some of them are, but they call themselves bogleheads. But they think of themselves as 100% get rich slow. They're so virtuous, so right, so righteous, so self-righteous. But then, you know, if you challenge them, they come back with, hey, I made mine, buddy. I'm rich. Look at these returns from the late 90s. I'm a lot smarter than you. They defend the get-rich-slow approach with get-rich-quick facts. And that tells you where their head really is. Their head is in get-rich-quick dreams. It's everything's upside down. Everything's perverted. And everything gets perverted because there's not emotional balance. And emotional balance has room for both get-rich-quick and get-rich-slow. You know what that makes me think of? I use that word perverted. It makes me think of pornography. I won't go on to it, but you know, if you have a healthy relationship, there's a place for physical intimacy in a healthy relationship. I'll just leave it at that. And an emotionally balanced person. And it doesn't get extreme in either direction. But the one extreme causes the other. Maybe a better example is drinking. You know, a lot of people say prohibition was an extreme. It was the extreme rational approach. I sometimes have sympathies with prohibition. I've had friends die in drunk driving incidents. And it hurts. And you think, maybe it wasn't such a bad idea when alcohol was banned. I drink when I go out socially, but I'd give it up in exchange for having some people alive. But we tried that, and the general consensus is the extremism of, you know, you could call that the get-rich-slow approach. You know, practical, responsible. To have no alcohol. Alcohol is, you know, illegal. But then underneath, what happens is you create this monster where people are, you know, drinking off the books. And it becomes more dangerous than having it in the open. So the point is, when we try to crush one side of ourselves, It never works. Because humans aren't made of one thing. We're not all rational. We're not all reason. We're not all logic. And we're not all emotion. And it doesn't work to cut, you know, to make things black and white. That's what I mean by the word goon. I use the word goon, and all that the word goon means is black and white thinking. People who can only see black and white are goons, and we've all got it inside us. We need to watch out for inner goonishness. And passive investing, the appeal of it is an emotionally unhealthy appeal. It's an appeal to the side of us that wants to get rich slow. So I want to stop always thinking about get rich slow as being a good thing. It is generally a good thing. It's generally where my heart is. Get rich slow is, well, in my heart, it's better than get rich quick. But it only works to have a mix. There's got to be some room for the get rich quick, and it can't be all get rich quick. There's got to be balance from the get rich slow. The two have to work together. We have to stop thinking of them as enemy camps. We need to reach out the hand of friendship to those with insights from the other side of the line. Those, if you're inclined to get rich quick, you need to learn from get rich slows. And if you're inclined personally to get rich slow, you need to learn from get rich quicks. So says Rob Bennett. If you think I've been too hard on the get rich slows, I would sure be grateful if you would let me know. If you would send an email, go to the site, passionsaving.com, and look down the left side of the page, and you'll find a thing that says Contact Rob, and you just push that button, and things happen. Good things. So do it. Do it, and you will, you too, can win $1 million. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.